Now, on today's 9 till noon show, and as part of our Wellness Wednesday programme, we speak to Saoirse McKelcher, who will tell us about her journey through education and overcoming her health issues. She's now a qualified nutritionist and has her own business, Saoirse's Healthy Living. Good morning, Saoirse. How are you getting on?
Hi, Greg. I'm good. Thank
Great
you.
To have you in. How are you keeping?
I'm good. Thanks.
Excited about the interview?
Yeah, I'm a bit nervous.
You don't worry about it. We'll be fine. Right. So your health story really goes back to a very young age. You were just a toddler, 2 years of age.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I can't really remember any different. Yeah. But I've heard the story that often. So I didn't start getting sick until I was about two. Mm. And I got very sore eyes. And then things started happening after that. I got really bad diarrhea and they didn't know what was causing it. I was in and out of Letterkenny Hospital, and I was also being seen in Temple Street for my eyes by Professor O'Keefe. And it wasn't until I was four until they actually diagnosed what was wrong with me, that I have a rare autoimmune condition.
And going out in the sun was harmful to you?
Yeah, and other things developed. If you look back at pictures, I had these red eyes, and I used to have to crawl up the hallway in the morning because my eyes would be so painful. And gosh. Then to walk from the house to the car, I would have to stand behind somebody's back. And I had a special cushion that I used in the car to hold over my face. Mm. So it was very painful. I got laser surgery done on my eyes when I was seven or eight, not that old. And since that, my eyes have improved a lot.
Very good. Now, you were eventually diagnosed. Was it after your sample was sent to Finland that the diagnosis was actually official at that point?
Yeah. So what happened was I went into a full body cramp because of low calcium.
Right.
And then they realised then through bloods that my thyroid gland wasn't working. And my endocrinologist in Crumlin, Dr. Costigan, I think he kind of had an idea then, and the bloods were sent off and it was confirmed.
But this is incredibly rare, so that's why I'm sure they want second and third opinions. Only one out of 20 people in the country have been diagnosed. You're one of only 20 people in the country to be diagnosed.
After I was diagnosed, they sent out, my doctor sent out a notice to other doctors to look out for patients who were, they had
same symptoms,
multiple autoimmune conditions, to test for them, and a lot more were diagnosed then.
Wow.
But so there was people going around that just thought they had autoimmune conditions and they actually had that.
What's it called? I'm going to let you do this one.
So it's, the long name is autoimmune polyendocrinopathy candidiasis exodermal dystrophy. Mm. That was my party piece when I was a child. I used to come out with all this Latin.
Yeah.
But it's abbreviated to APCET syndrome or APS1.
It's really interesting, actually, how your doctor circulating this info led to a lot of questions being answered, because I suppose in your family as well, obviously initially, your caregivers are going, well, we don't know what's going on. From two to four, it's a long time. I mean, looking back now, it might say, well, it was 2 to 4. But, we're living through that, not knowing what the right thing to do. And then I suppose, what was their reaction? Did they ever tell you what the reaction was, is when they knew what it was and then could start sort of dealing with it and giving you as normal a childhood as possible?
Well, I did ask my mum this once, and she said she actually didn't take it in at all, really.
Mm.
It was just at that point, I suppose, she was probably happy that she knew exactly what was wrong with me. But then it was just kind of from then on, it was just survival mode then. Taking one day as it goes. And both my mum and my dad are amazing, because I have two younger sisters as well. So they had that. And
there's a lot to juggle, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a lot to juggle.
And they have to make sure that they're giving as much attention to everybody. And it's often when there is a child that needs an additional care, especially when there are siblings.
Oh, yeah.
Parents,
my sisters will definitely, they'll say, yeah, she got all attention.
But you were the firstborn anyway. You deserved that.
I know,
that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm saying, whatever.
Yeah.
So when we talk of it, autoimmune disease. You've got 9. Our immune system is there, and you know, I'm not a doctor, of course, to protect us, right? So is it a case that your body's kind of attacking itself? Is that how you would sort of phrase that?
The way they explained it to me in Crumlin was that our immune systems are made up of like tiny little soldiers, and in my immune system, I have some rogue soldiers that go a bit crazy every so often and attack me instead. Now I am getting IV immunoglobulin, so they did decide then to kind of kill off my immune system with a medication, and now I get an infusion every week to replace that.
Yeah, so in other words, this rogue army and the regular army, they've been disbanded.
Yeah.
And to make sure that, you know, stuff that you're vulnerable for, you're injected to best protect you.
Yeah, so okay. That's from what I understand anyway. Mm. And so far anyway, since I've been getting that treatment, despite having to be a lot more careful for infections, I haven't had any more autoimmune diseases, touch wood.
So in terms of, you know, your treatment as a child and teenage years, did your life function somewhat normally? You know, did you become used to this, or was it very disruptive? How did it affect you and your education?
I don't think I started to realise it up until I started secondary school, to be honest.
Right,
because primary school, I was barely there anyway.
Yeah.
And
would that be because of hospital appointments or
being
illness?
Yeah, sick and hospital appointments. And then at that age too, you be with your parents, like your parents go everywhere with you anyway. Then I remember when I started secondary school, I had realised other people my age were having a lot more freedom than me. And it was a bit disheartening, because on one hand, even if my parents did decide to let me go off and, I don't know, do whatever, I wasn't well enough to do it.
Yeah, so, it was a tough balance for them to strike too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To protect you, but to give you a little bit of independence here and there. I wouldn't like to have to sort of walk that line, but they did as best they could, quite clearly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, I think it's as much about age and self-awareness as rather than which school you're in, isn't it? It's sort of like, you know, you start seeing way more people, because you've grown up with your friends in national school as much as you've seen them, but then you go to secondary, all the schools come into the one place, and you sort of start going, well, she's not like that, or he's not like that there. And so that took a bit of working through, or did it weigh on you throughout your whole education, your secondary education?
It kind of does, because for me, my life's obviously very different. For me, hospitals, injections, medication as a normal. When I start talking about it to other people, I don't realise that there's people out there who have never been in a hospital before. Like, they have no idea what I'm talking about. And I had to get very good at kind of realising that when I was talking to other people, and almost not hide it, but just not bring it up as much, which also meant there was a lot less things I could feel I could talk about, because I didn't really know.
But I suppose too, there's bound to be a part of you that don't want to be defined by your illness either. You want to be, you know, you want to be for people to understand that there's so much more to you.
Yeah.
And how did you do in your education in secondary school with everything that you were sort of trying to keep the balls in the air, so to speak?
I done quite well, because I'm quite competitive. And as well, that when I was in hospital, I used to get my SNA to send my work in to me. Yeah. So
you asked?
Yeah, I asked. Okay. She would be emailed, and she would make me tell everybody that I wanted her to do that, though, because it made her look kind of bad. But I insisted, because I didn't want to land back in school and be behind on top of everything else. So while I was in hospital, like, the way I thought of it, there's a lot of waiting around.
Use the time, pass the time that way. So you got your leaving cert?
I got my leaving cert.
Well done, okay.
And I went on then to ATU, Letterkenny, and got my bachelor's in food science.
Hold on a second. I've got 15 minutes left of this interview. You've just told old bloody... Right then, thanks so much for calling in, Saoirse. So then you decided to go to... nutrition, right? Because you're a qualified nutritionist. Yeah. That's what... because of what you went through and the issues with gaining weight and your diet and, you know, being conscious of food and eating, did it become clear early on that you could sort of become an expert in this area and help other people and yourself in the process?
I think it was more the fact that I just found it very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember dietitians coming in to see me in the hospital and they'd get on with like whatever the reason I'm there for, and then I'd just have a nice wee chat with them then. So I also loved learning about the way your body works, because that's what I've
heard so much
about.
Info about it, and it is, you know, as negatively as it has impacted you at times as well, it is really quite fascinating how the body works and how one body or one person's system can work different to another and why and what we can do to sort of work with it and stuff. So secondary school's one thing, right? That's a big leap from national school.
Yeah.
Now, ATU's, now we're getting into, you know, the big leagues here, because, you know, obviously you're coming of an age where you want even more independence.
Yeah.
And I presume along that way there were really quite significant milestones for you, not just in education, but I suppose in you as a late teen young adult and you know, finding your feet in your independence.
Yeah, like I remember looking back now, my first week at secondary school, I got asked to go out to lunch, like down the town or whatever. And like to most other teenagers, that's not that big a thing. To me, like that was the best thing to happen to me. Like that was the highlight. Like I was allowed to go off on my own, well, with other teenagers. And now it was literally from the old Finn Valley College to where they used to have Kiernan's. Like, it was like not that far.
But for you, it
for
was...
For me, it was, and then...
Because it was normality, wasn't it?
Yeah, like nobody really mentioned anything about medical conditions or blood sugars or anything. I was just...
Sorcerer.
Yeah, I was just like them.
One of the crew. And were there more of those experiences as you moved to the ATU?
Yeah, there was, but I suppose... As I got older, then everyone else around me started to grow older as well and go to things like discos. I remember having very heated arguments with my mother that I wanted to go to Glenties. And she was like, most of the time, like my mum and dad, they would let me go to teen discos, but they would sit outside in the car, which was a good job because some of the times I would actually have to come out to them because my blood sugars would go low or something. Mm. So mum is like, do you really expect me to go the whole way to Glenties with you? And I was like, yes. But turns out I didn't get to Glenties, but I'm happy enough. I think I was okay. I wasn't too hard done by.
Good stuff. You did the undergrad at ATU and you wanted to continue continue your education to go on for your master's. So everything so far is closer to home, right? So you ended up going down to UCD.
Yeah.
Is that a complication with your condition?
It
what
was.
So and what did you overcome to make that happen?
Well, the thing is, when I was doing my CAO, I actually put down UCD.
Mm.
And in my mind, I was going to UCD.
Yeah.
And looking back at that point, I was not well enough to be going anywhere. So I think for a while, people kind of went along with it, and then they realised I actually believed that I was going, and they kind of said, you know, try closer to home first. I'm very glad I went to ATU first, because it was like talking about a leap from primary school, secondary school. I was like, a much bigger leap. The first week at ATU, just for me, because I have Addison's disease, a lot of changes. It's like a dominoes effect. Everything goes haywire. That first week at ATU was like, I think I got 2 ambulance rides, 3 trips to the hospital, and I think I only missed 2 classes though. So I was like, well, just wait till this class is over.
How did you squeeze it all in?
I don't know.
I know.
I was very tired after that week.
But I mean, there's a fun. I mean, obviously, this is your competitive spirit. You had UCD set in your head.
Yeah.
You were a regular attendee at St. James. They're not a million miles away, right? So you can make this work. But did you need additional support in Dublin as part of being able to move there once you were accepted?
Yeah. So my mum and dad are my full-time carers at home, and they do like. I couldn't go from that to nothing. And I knew that. So I knew that I would have to have at least an overnight care, because for me at night, that's when most things start to go wrong.
Haywire, yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose you say petitioned the HSE for this. And it was a very long, very stressful road. It was a battle. And there were a few times that I just thought, you know, is this really worth it?
So I know you were back and forwards with the HSE for 2 years. So did you have to defer UCD until you won that battle with them?
No, I didn't apply until I was kind of sure I was getting somewhere.
Understood, yeah.
And then I applied thinking, oh, I think they're going to say yes. So, but I actually got accepted to UCD before they had actually said yes.
Right.
So I had to contact UCD because they give you, I think, 2 weeks to accept. And I was like, please keep my spot. I don't know when I can say yes, but I can't say yes until I know this is sorted. And they were so good. Like, wow. UCD were brilliant from
the
beginning.
And how long did it take then?
It was like 6 weeks after I should have accepted.
Yeah, but your gut was right, you know.
Yeah.
So they help fund care.
Yeah.
So they provide funding, you get a carer yourself, and it turns out a former schoolmate was one of your carers.
I knew she'd gone on to be a nurse, and I just thought, I actually contacted her because I thought she might know of anybody who would be up for like a job like that. It was only nighttime care, so it was like 15 hours at night, and they would be in a separate room, so they'd be able to sleep and all, just be able
on call, yeah, on call more or less.
And Ailis had been living in Cork, and she was moving back, and she said that she would do the first couple of weeks anyway to get me settled. And honestly, the fact that I knew Ailis already, it really helped me settle in. And she's brilliant, like so competent in all medical phase. My parents were really comfortable.
They have to be assured in this because they've invested so much emotion in you. And I think, you know, the easiest thing in the world would try and play it safe, hold you back, say, you know, can you not do this? This is available here. But for you, Ted, down to Dublin, big, I know, listen, all the credit's yours, right? But I know as a parent, they had to let you go a bit as well, like, didn't they? And things like getting to and from, having that independence, being in a city, I mean, do you grow an awful lot yourself then?
Definitely.
You know, when you're on confidence, what you can achieve.
I have no sense of direction, Greg. So I think that's what worried my mum
and
my dad a lot, that I would just be lost all the time. Now, UCD is the campus itself. I did get lost quite a few times because it's so big.
Yes.
When I figured out that the 39A bus basically gets me most places,
go,
I was like, right, I'll just stick to that bus and I'll be okay. It did take me a while to get comfortable enough to venture off campus. But once I'd done it first couple of times, like, I would manage to get myself in and out of Dundrum and into the city centre.
And at this stage, you were able to socially spread your wings a bit more, because there's obviously academic growth, right? But there's your life growth here. And I presume that was everything fast-forwarded then. Yeah.
Like, I joined the UCD Dance Society, and they were so welcoming as well. And then I loved dancing as well. I danced with Aisling Academy in Stranorlar, and it was great to just be able to take loads of different workshops, meet loads of people that have the same interests. And like, UCD has so many different clubs and societies as well, so I was spoiled for choice.
Right, so I mean, you're getting an insight too into your own health and nutrition and the importance of what goes into your body and how it can help, whether it's gaining weight, whether it is loose stools, whatever it might be, right? So you're learning, but you're also doing at the same time, aren't you? Because so this gives you, I think, as a fully qualified nutritionist, this gives you sort of like a huge advantage, because you know exactly how important one's diet can be.
Yeah, and for me as well, the gut is...
What do we mean when we talk about the gut's health?
Yeah, so it's basically anything in your digest, from your mouth, your throat, like right down your stomach and till it comes
into
out the
bowels,
end, everything. So for me, that's always been medically my biggest issue. that's why I'm actually on a very specialised tube feed now, because I can't absorb my food. But I realised whenever I started this tube feed and started getting the right nutrition, how much better I became, like infection-wise, energy-wise, my skin, my hair, everything.
So it's not really how the food is delivered, whether it be a tube or your mouth. It's actually what goes into your system that's the critical thing,
And as well, that like gut health is a big thing, is kind of coming out now, how more important your gut health is for everything from sleep, weight maintenance, whether it's gaining weight or losing weight, mental health as well. It's a big link between mental health, because if you think about it, like a lot of people that have gut issues like IBS, Crohn's disease and all, they do suffer from some kind of mental health issues.
And stress can be a trigger.
Stress trigger, those, For me, if I get stressed, the first thing to go is my stomach.
Yeah.
So I know that my gut plays a big role in any part of me, really.
So do you work across the spectrum in nutrition, or do you specialise in certain cases, or?
No, so I would try and help anybody I could, like, obviously. And I do kind of focus on the gut, because I don't like to give somebody advice, because I believe nutrition is personalised.
Mm.
So I don't like to give them advice without any evidence to back it up. So I do offer this gut microbiome test, and then once you do that, I can get results to show your specialised, your gut microbiome, how healthy it is, what you need
to
do.
But I think that helps the client understand it, because otherwise it can feel just like words.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and you need people to buy in, because sometimes results take a while.
Yeah,
so if you can say, look, this is evidence-based, this is where you're at now, and this is where we can take you.
Yeah.
I think that's really that's a really good way of relating the info.
Yeah, and like I don't really believe in diets, because number one, they don't work for everybody. So you're going to get some people who they might work for, and other people who are trying so hard and they're just not working, because we're all different. And also, you can't maintain a diet all your life. You want something that's going to help you reach your goals, that you can stay there and not keep having to go back and diet again.
Because of the nature of your work, are you able to do it primarily from home, exclusively from home?
Yeah, well, that's kind of, I set it up during COVID on, I have a website, sourceshealthyloving.com, because
just get the plug in there.
Yeah, get the plug in. because I can't drive. So I was like, I need to find something that I don't have to go driving or get people to drive me places.
But
it's a
perfect trade to sort of be able to do.
I've done web chats from hospital room. Like, nobody needs to know, and I'm comfortable with doing it, you know.
Exactly. And and what's the most satisfying part of it? Is it seeing the improvements in people?
Yeah.
Because I presume you get invested in their story, right? And their journey too. Is that where you get the real thrill from the job?
Yeah. That's what, when I see people and, you know, they just say, you know, I feel so much better. That's worse.
And you referenced earlier on about how your nutrition at the moment, it so much is affected by, like, I haven't drank any water today, right? Don't shoot me. I've had a couple of cups of coffee, right? But, you know, I can feel my muscles tightening in my back. I've kind of got a bit of brain fog. Do you know that sort of way, or that sense of, you know, and I know I should do better, and I do try and do better, but it's astonishing, even just the absence of water for a couple of hours, how it can start impacting your vision.
Yeah.
You know, all that type of stuff. And I'm only just on the most basic water level, let alone all the stuff that you can talk about and get involved in.
Yeah. And like, I try and keep nutrition as uncomplicated as possible, because if it gets too complicated, people just zone out.
Yeah, exactly.
And basically, if you eat more fiber, drink more water, and try and stay away from processed foods as much as possible, that's all you need to do.
Yeah, but I think you're realistic in that it has to be maintainable diet, doesn't it?
Maintainable,
because we can't all switch to weighing everything and, you know, I'll get you. So how's is your health story then an ongoing story now? Are you in a steady space now, though? You know, you're getting your weekly injections, you've found a nutritional food source for you. Like, are you in a good steady space at the moment, or is it one challenge challenge at a time, or what's the story?
It's always going to be one challenge at a time. I suppose at present, I'm in good form. It could go from 0 to 100. I don't know, like, but it's not as bad as it used to be. I am a lot healthier now than I was at secondary school or primary school. Brilliant. And there is, for me, the nutrition, the tube feed nutrition, is working for me, but the only issue that my doctors have is the actual central line I get it through as a source of infection, and with my condition it's an even bigger
prone to infections, of
and
course,
I've had a few already. I had a few really bad ones, and they're afraid that the next one might not, like, you know, so they're trying to figure out a way to get me off the tube feed. And so there is a few things going on, but my doctor's in James's, and I have a gastro doctor here in Letterkenny as well, Dr. Steele. They're all, like, they all look after me so well.
They're all on Team Shawshire.
Yeah, okay. I hope so anyway. Yes,
okay, listen, Saoirse, thanks so much for calling in. I really do appreciate your time. If anyone wants any more information about the services you provide, what is your website again?
It's saoirseshealthyliving.com.
And is it McElcher, is it?
McElcher.
What?
McElcher.
M-C, hold on a second.
Yeah.
M-C-E-L-C-H-R.
I know.
And you want me to say McElcher?
Yeah.
Well, okay, I will.
That's not the worst. You should hear what they call me in the hospital waiting rooms.
Oh, I don't want to hear it. Well, not at this time in the morning. No. I'm only messing. Saoirse McElcher, thank you so much for calling in. Loads of people texting in that know you and those that don't. Do you like when people say you're an inspiration? Does that not every, some people go, you know, some people say, well, I'm just living my life. This is my story. If I inspire people, fine, but I don't know.
It's nice. It's nice if people think that, but I literally am just, you know, I'm not trying to inspire anybody, but if I do, then, you know.
Well, you are, let me say. And I'll read some of those comments a little later on. It's been lovely having you in. Thank you so very much indeed.
Thank you.
We do appreciate your time. And that was Wellness Wednesday for this Wednesday. And that was the excellent Saoirse McElcher. One more time, the website?
Saoirseshealthyliving.com.
All right. We'll be back with Business News and Chris Ashmore after these.
Business Matters on Highland Radio is brought to you by Local Enterprise Office Donegal. If you have an idea to start or grow your business within Donegal, contact the Local Enterprise Office to find out more about the supports available for businesses. See localenterprise.ie/Donegal.
All right, Chris, and we'll start with news of supports to actually get your business off the ground.
Yes, just wanted to let people aware of the Local Enterprise Office is running a Start Your Own Business program. Now, this is a virtual one, so you go online. It's beginning on Tuesday the 6th of May from 6 to 9:30 p.m. It's done over 8 sessions, 2 evenings per week across 4 weeks. So look, if you have an idea of a business, or maybe you're in the early stages of starting one, this is a great way of helping you to develop your business plan and idea with expert support, and it costs just €25. So, yeah, you know, a tiny investment for a potentially very big return on that.
You're committing yourself to something. You want to make sure you're getting it right.
Yeah.
There's a business survey out or concluded in Donegal?
Yeah, now the Letterkenny Chamber has, it's called the Business Sentiment Survey, and essentially they're looking for people to fill out the survey. It takes about 10 minutes online. The topics will include what are the biggest challenges you face in your business, what are the opportunities. All responses are confidential, and the feedback will help shape the Chamber's own business agenda going forward. And you don't have to be a member of the Chamber, but it's a communications exercise, but it's helping to identify what the big issues are out there.
Yeah, interesting. It seems to follow sort of national, international trends too, how sentiment is affected. Networking is a huge part of business, and there's a big event coming up with Donegal Women in Business.
Yeah, now the Donegal Women in Business Network, they have been doing this for a number of years now. It sounds very simple. It's an annual coffee morning. They have a number of events around the county, but look, it's a chance to go along in a very relaxed atmosphere, meet people who are in other businesses, exchanging ideas. So they have venues in Donegal Town, Buncrana, Dunloe, Letterkenny, details on their Facebook page. It's all happening on Friday the 16th of May, so we're giving it plenty of advance notice. Has been very popular in the last couple of years. So as I say, Friday the 16th of May, and nicely scattered around the county, the Donegal Women in Business Network.
What's this about Donegal Company and Fit Workers? The figures are astonishing here.
Yeah, now this is, it certainly is.
I can rule out Highland Radio at this early stage.
Well, TCS Global, as it's called here in Letterkenny, just down the road from us here in the business park, they took part in an Irish Life Workplace Fitness Challenge. So basically, they were given a three-week challenge. Workers were measured how many steps they were doing. They got a large number involved, and over 3 weeks, combined total of everybody was 26 million steps. So that got them into the top five. And look, it's all about having a healthy workforce, encouraging people to have a little bit of exercise. So ticked a lot of the boxes, Greg.
Yeah, now this week's podcast, which will be live this afternoon on our website, this is an interesting one. We talked about starting your own business, but this is one of those that are really, really interesting. They're all interesting, Chris, but this one piqued my interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, some years ago, the McGeehan family here in Letterkenny, breakfast in the morning, and Brian McGeehan at the time was working in Seagate in Derry, and often he had to leave early before the kids went to school, and quite often he might have been on his way into Derry and he got a call, "What are the roads like?" And his sons Owen and Ronan were in Colostra Alley, and they entered the Young Scientist Exhibition up in Dublin because they thought, well, look, there's lots of people out on the roads. Could we alert people when there's black ice? Mm-hmm. And what started off as a conversation, they looked into it. And essentially, they won the Young Scientist competition. They got a patent. They got a trip to Seattle. They got a prize. Roll forward a few years, and Brian McGeehan, he took a package in Seagate, and he has now gone full-time into this. And what they have is basically a device. Now, as most people will be aware, water expands when it freezes. So they used a chemical solution. And when there was expansion, a blue liquid went up over the lens of the cat's eye. So the cat's eye went from white to being blue. So in essence, what would happen is you would have a cat's eye. And when the ground temperature freezes, this little device will change the color of the cat's eye to
indicating
blue.
Black eyes.
So you're out in your car and you'll see it maybe 100, 150 yards in advance. So from a road safety point of view, the problem with black ice is you don't know it's suddenly there. Mm-hmm. But if you get this warning that the road temperature is freezing or below, and there's a blue cat's eye there, you're going
to
slow down.
It doesn't have to be every cat's eye necessarily.
No, no. Okay. So it certainly has massive potential, and he's based in CoLab here in the ATU in Letterkenny developing it. And the hope could be within the next year or two, it could come to market, and a huge potential market out there.
So the entire mechanism is power-free. It has no power source. It's based on physics and chemistry. And everyone understands that when water freezes, it expands. It actually expands by 9%. So the expansion was what the boys used as a trigger mechanism for alerting drivers. So when the expansion takes place, it triggers a change in volume. That change in volume displaces a blue liquid, which will change the colour of the light as the light reflects through it. It hits off the back and reflects back through it a second time and on its way back to the driver. So that's how that works.
All right, Chris's full conversation with Brian McGeehan, and that could be, he could be hearing about something that could be, revolutionise travel in areas prone to black ice. That full podcast will be available a little after 12. Chris, it's broadcast on Sunday as well.
That's right, it'll be broadcast on Sunday after the 6 o'clock news, and the long-term aim will be to actually manufacture these new versions of the cat's eyes here and replace them countries, potentially all over the world.
Astonishing stuff. If anyone wants to get in contact with you?
Best way is by email. The email address is businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Thank you, Chris. See you next Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thanks so very much indeed. Now, The Last Ditch is a new book, and if you just looked at it on the face of it, you'd believe it's a book about sport. Its author is Eamon Sweeney, and Eamon, it is a book about sport, isn't it? But much more as well. The reader is getting an awful lot from your work. Congratulations on getting your latest work out. And tell us about the book.
About the book. You can hear me, Greg, can you?
Oh, loud and clear. I just presume I could. Go ahead, Eamon.
I'm a bit of a new hand at this kind of...
Well, you're doing brilliant.
On Zoom and
you're
stuff.
Perfectly framed and you sound great. I can't say that of all our guests. Go ahead, Eamon.
That's grand. It's a book about following the championship in 2024, and it's a follow up to a book I did in 2003. It's also about the fact that when I took on the book, I didn't think I had any hope of actually writing it, because I'd been kind of crippled with this anxiety, which had prevented me largely travelling beyond Skibbereen, where I live, for years, So kind of, it was a bit of a punt taking on the book to see if I'd be able to do it at all, you know.
Did you do it retrospectively, or did you write it through the year? Or not necessarily write it through the year, but, you know, log what you thought might be included?
I kind of kept a diary as I went along, but the funny thing about it was, when I started, I had in mind a fairly straightforward thing of matches from week to week to week. And then when it finished, I met the editor of the book, and on the way out, we met for a coffee, and on the way out, I said, do you know something? The gas thing is, I didn't think I'd get this book at all, because when I took it on from you, I hadn't travelled anywhere in years. And she said, but sure, that's the book. She said, that people would be interested in that, you know. So I said, well, yeah, you know, that's maybe I'll do that. So I had to kind of junk all the stuff I'd written up to then and kind of rewrite it then, from kind of bringing that in, you know.
So there's an awful lot going on there. And it amazes me about authors, how you can structure it, right? So how you can intertwine, and this has been so broadly welcomed, right? How you can intertwine, you know, and the championships throw amazing stories every year, but in your own personal journey, what you're overcoming, to be able to intertwine all of that into a book, I find fascinating that people have that ability and skill.
Yeah, well, I suppose the books, in a way, it was a long time since I'd written a book, but in a way, it kind of wrote itself. And because I suppose if you're very much into sport, and I suppose my life is sport, I write about sport, I go to sport and so on. A lot of the landmarks of your life are like, well, that's the time. For example, I remember my first daughter was born the day Roy Keane was sent back from Saipan. You know, so you tend to be counting out things like that. My mother had a stroke the day of the All-Ireland hurling final when Limerick beat Cork. And so in a way that it's naturally interspersed in your head, in a way, you know, and even this kind of terrible anxiety I was suffering largely manifested itself in the fact that, you know, I couldn't go to matches. Was the real kind of killer. So, I mean, that's in a way it kind of structures itself, you know, and also I suppose that was the point when I set off on the book. I thought, I mean, what are the chances this is going to be finished? I'm going to kind of fall by the wayside, because I'd been very much kind of, you know, diminished by anxiety and stuff over the years. But week by week, it went on. And by the end, at the start, I was enduring it. And by the end, I was enjoying it, you know.
So, I mean, this is genuinely your journey as well.
It is my journey. I mean, it was, to be honest, about 10 weeks before they asked me to do the book, I'd had the worst ever attack I'd had. I was very close to, I mean, I don't know, do you use the word madness, but I certainly was in a very, very, very bad place that I dreaded for years. And I sat at home and I said, that's it, I'm never moving beyond the bounds of Skibbereen again. And then the editor pops up and says, do you want to do this book? You could be travelling all over Ireland. You did 21 years ago. She hadn't a clue what was going on. And I, like, to be honest, originally I tried to put her off, and as my daughters would say, told me, what you're doing, that is called ghosting. I was kind of not answering phone calls from her. And and then my daughters actually said to me, sure, Dad, you know, make a real effort to do this. Maybe this is the push you need. Maybe this is, you know, the kind of, you know, big moment, like go for it or and see what happens. So I said, well, what have I to lose? So I kind of, you know, I went to a psychologist, I went to a doctor, I took medication, I said, well, this is it. We'll see how far we go. Even the first match I went to, I was kind of on my way out to the pitch, I was hit by another attack, and I thought, this is never going to fly. But you'll go to the match and see how far you get. And as it turned out, I made it through to the end. And in a way, by doing the book, the whole thing seemed to leave me as it went along. You know, I hadn't, like, my travel anxiety was so bad, I hadn't left the country in 24 years. And after I finished the book, I went to Paris and I went to Amsterdam. So there's a singer I really like, the blues singer called Buddy Guy, and he always says that the thing about the blues is you can only sing the blues if you have the blues, he says, but if you sing them, you lose them, you know?
Yes, a wise man too. I don't know how you continue a career with that in your way. But it's a book that's been because I haven't had an opportunity to read it, Eamon, but I do trust people's opinions in it. And when you have a book that's about different things, but it's the hook is the sport and all that type of stuff, you know, you want to please the sports enthusiasts, right? You're putting out a journey other people have been on there in terms of mental health, so you want to represent that as well. And then, of course, you know, you have to give some of yourself, and you've given much of yourself to this book. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of people to please, most importantly, I think, yourself in all of that.
It proved to be, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, a life-changing experience. Before I wrote it, I could go nowhere. By the end, I'd got my mojo back, as they say, you know, and I was back enjoying stuff. And I'd missed it because I suppose the closest thing I could compare it is, like, during lockdown, which was fierce, when people couldn't go anywhere, and it was only when they went back and realised then lockdown was over and they really appreciated stuff. I'd been in my own personal lockdown for years, you know, for the guts of a decade. And to go back and to do something as simple as go to a match and walk in and be surrounded by people and having the chat on the way to it and seeing the game and that is, it was just a fantastic, fantastic experience. I mean, I wrote myself kind of out of anxiety and into, you know, into happiness, which is a great
brilliant
thing.
And I've spoken to a number of people that their life improved so much during lockdown. Social pressures were off them with various different things. They were able to stay at home and it be socially acceptable to do so. It's astonishing how different things impact people in different ways. 2024, and maybe it's the same with every season, but it seems particularly from a sporting perspective. Of course, from our own perspective, the return of Jim McGuinness. We're still riding that wave. You know, the grounds are packed, getting games for home league games, getting tickets. It's like an All-Ireland final, right? We're still riding that. Of course, the women's game continues its ascension. Great things happening in terms of hurling and football. A great year to sort of capture from a sporting perspective too, Eamon. What's your peaks and your highlights?
Well, the interesting thing was it was probably the best hurling championship of all time. It was fantastic. There was one classic after another, especially in Munster, packed and so on. And the thing was, it was probably the worst football championship of all time. But that was interesting in a way, because you saw after years of football getting worse and worse and worse, it more or less kind of disintegrated last year, the championship. I'll never forget being up at a game between Derry and Kerry, which was the low ebb. And a Derry woman behind me stood up and shouted, "Come on, Derry, bore them into submission." You know? and that kind of summed
Stop
it up.
Stop stealing our tactics.
Yeah.
Well, and old school.
There was a Donegal woman beside me. The previous game had been between Donegal and Louth, yeah, and she'd stayed on to watch it, and she showed me her phone, and it was a friend of her texted and said to her, "Are you still stuck watching this atrocity?" And I mean, there was a kind of a... And at the end of the season, they changed the football rules completely, so that we're playing almost a completely different game this year. So, but it was interesting to see that. But the return of Jim McGuinness was great. I mean, somebody like Jim McGuinness, it is fantastic to see him back. You know, his box office, he's interesting. He's you know, he makes the game, not just in Donegal, he makes the game bigger, you know. He makes the game more exciting.
So true.
And the rise of Donegal was astounding. He took over a team which was at an absolute low ebb, and everyone was like, yeah, well, you know, Jimmy is obviously a miracle worker, but this is going to take 2 or 3 years. And in fact, Donegal could have won the All-Ireland football
and fundamentally
last year,
you know? The same team, really.
Yeah, the same team, not any, you know, good players, but not nothing outstanding about them. And then you suddenly saw, you know, guys like Pather Mogul and so on looked like supermen under Jimmy. And they'll be very close this year. I suspect you have a reasonable chance of hosting some kind of All-Ireland celebration show in a few months, you know.
Well, I'm trying to not talk about that, but yeah, I feel like we might. And I suppose too, the GAA is us, isn't it? It's a community, and you sort of, I suppose, allowed yourself back into that community, and I presume it, you know, not just what happened on the pitch, but in the stands as well, helped you on your journey.
I did. I mean, there's something incredibly benign about the GAA. You know, we look at the headlines in the newspapers every day and somebody's killing, you know, awful thing happening to the people in Gaza, or, you know, horrendous things happened this morning in Kashmir. But I mean, you need sometimes to look at the benign phenomenon of loads of people, you know, traveling all over the country to follow their teams, and the friendliness. And it's a very kind of a GAA thing. You know, everyone you meet has to have a conversation with you. You know, you sit down beside someone at a stand in the stand, you learn about their thing, you know, you see the fans talking to each other. It's a great community thing. I always think the GAA is, following the championship is almost the best and most representative way to see Ireland in a way, you know. Yes. And it's the friendliest way, you know. I mean, it is, you know, the GAA is the GAA. I give out about it like everyone else, but it's, you know.
I think we can give out of it, because there's that sense of ownership as well, and you can sort of give out about stuff that you love. And I get
you can
angry
indeed,
with them,
yeah. You know, you're comfortable in that. You know, it's like, it's always like the way you give out about a family member, but
exactly,
at the end they're
yeah.
still family. You know,
Michael Harden said, "A blistering book that everyone who loves football, hurling, or just life in general will relish enormously." Mike McCormick says, "A truly valuable account of both how vulnerable and resilient a man can be. No doubt about it. The Last Ditch is one of the books of the year." And Michael Clifford, a man of three words, a cracking read, but that'll do too. Listen, I can only scratch the surface in the time we had, Eamon. I think people need to get a hold of this book themselves if they love sport. And sometimes I think we learn most when we're not realising that we're learning most. You know what I mean? So you can read a book about sport and great sport and memories, but maybe learn a little bit about, you know, your own resilience or where you're at in your life as well. And you know, I think it's a little bit sometimes like when, you know, dementia is in a stage comedy. You know, sometimes we can discuss things and learn more when things seem out of context, though it's not. You get where I'm coming from?
Oh, I do indeed. And I always think like that you can't really put sport in one box and life in another.
Yes,
you know,
how could you?
Sport is part of
sport
life.
Sport is life.
Know?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, sport is life, you know, for a lot of us.
Eamon, the book's available in all the usual places, of course, and it comes incredibly highly recommended. And I really, really appreciate your time. And I'm actually really warmed that your life has turned around in such a way. It's wonderful to hear that.
Thank you, Greg.
So
that's
really
nice.
I'm pleased for you and those that care for you, because they watched on as well. So I'm glad to see you back to yourself.
Thank you. Thanks very, very much, Greg. Thanks for
Take
having me.
Take care of yourself, buddy. Thanks so very much indeed. The Last Ditch, available in all the usual places. That's The Last Ditch for us here now. We're back tomorrow morning at 9. Thank you very much for listening.